If you've spent any time in the last couple of months driving on rural Iowa roads, you already know that this has been a very good year for pheasants. Iowa's pheasant population is the highest it's been in 6 years. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. We'll find out why it's been a banner year for pheasants. We'll also talk turkey, quail, and other game birds. Jim also just returned from a trip to Costa Rica where he saw 190 different species of birds. We'll talk about his experiences and a new report out from the Audubon Society that shows us a bleak future for North American birds. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa's roadsides are chock-a-block with pheasants this year, and there are plenty of turkeys out there, too. This hour, we'll talk about Iowa's game birds, but we're going to start the hour with some more exotic species. And with me today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Hello, Jim.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And you may still be a little jet-lagged. Are you recovered?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. We're in the same hemisphere, so it makes a jet lag easier to deal with.
All right. And you just got back from a trip to Costa Rica. Tell me what you were doing there.
Well, I've been leading student trips there for over 20 years. And in the last few years since I retired, I've been leading trips for legacy tours. These are natural history trips, and so we're concerned with certainly wildlife and the birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, but also the plants. We go to four or five different life zones within the country and explore what the biodiversity is like in each of those areas. And I went with a terrific group of folks. They really gelled nicely. It's been my experience that these are folks who are very interested in the outdoors and especially interested in seeing wildlife along the way.
And how many different species of birds did you see?
Well, we were at 190, right at 190 species, which is average for this time of year. This is sort of the non-breeding season in most of the life zones we were in for most birds, not all, but most birds. And if we go during the middle of the winter, there are many farther North American species that are here now will be in Costa Rica, so we have closer to 300 usually during the midwinter months, but 190 now is very good. That's a lot of different critters, and for lots of folks, of course, many of these species are resident in Costa Rica and Central America. And in some cases, some are endemic to just those areas. For example, we saw several endemic species that are only found there in the cloud forests of Costa Rica, and nowhere else. So it's a really special trip, and I've been very blessed to be able to take good folks down to one of my favorite places on the world for a number of years now.
So is there a species that is always a highlight for you on these trips?
Oh, really, there are lots of them. Certainly seeing a quetzal, that's a totally tropical group of birds called trogons that are primarily seed eaters. And the quetzal is the bright green one with the red chest. The male has this totally red chest, and during the breeding season, they have this tail that is about 2 feet long that when they're on the eggs, the tail actually sticks out the front of the nest. So that's always a special one, but I enjoy seeing lots of the species that are there, including toucans and other species as well.
Well, there was some bad news out today from the Audubon Society that is about some of those birds that winter in Costa Rica, but the birds of North America, the birds that spend their summers in North America, this new study that was just released today shows us a very bleak future for a lot of North American birds because of global warming.
Yeah, because of the changing of the climate. And I saw the article in the complete article in the New York Times. So if people want to go to the New York Times, they can find it online. And it is certainly not... it's been confirmed by other studies as well. I think this is the most comprehensive one that's looked at a bunch of the studies going on. There are other studies that show, too, that there are some special problems as birds move their – are forced to move their ranges, their nesting ranges farther north. There may or may not be the kinds of insects – the kinds of plants, the seeds that they need in those ranges, because the plants may not change quite as quickly as the birds need to, and that's a real threat. There are also gaps in where grasslands are, for example. Right now, it was another study I saw earlier that said all across southern Canada, where it is very, very intensive agriculture, there's such a gap in where grasslands are that grassland birds in particular may not be able to make the jump quickly enough in order to avoid being eliminated from the from the earth. So it's a real concern, a very real concern.
As I mean, Iowa, we've talked about this a number of times. Yeah. As things have changed, as the climate has changed, Iowa has benefited in some ways from having some species in the state that we didn't have for quite some time, and there have been other changes that have influenced that as well. But, you know, we're seeing a lot more pelicans, for mm-hmm. example, and some other birds as well. As things change, isn't there a chance that birds from the south will just move north?
Yeah, there is, except that this whole idea of whether or not, for example, insect-eating birds. Many birds specialize on certain groups of insects, not on a single species by any means, but certain groups of insects. And it may be that those insects will not adapt or will not move north as quickly as they need to in order to serve as food for the birds. So this is a very chancy thing. And it's not that things haven't changed before. And we've seen how, as you mentioned, how resilient many species can be. And we're going to see that when we talk about pheasants here in a minute. But the resiliency of the species is very, very dependent upon the habitat that they occupy. And if the plants and the critters that they are dependent on don't move as quickly as they do, there may be more threats than we can imagine at the moment. It's the rapidity of the change that is kind of scary. Not the fact that it's changing. Nature is very changing. Lots of species are resilient. But it's the speed of that change that is causing the really, you know, we're not sure on predictions what to predict. People don't want to be terribly, dire in their predictions, but it's hard not to be, that's for sure.
Well, and the timeline in this study is really frightening. I mean, it's in the lifetime of my kids, of many people's kids.
Right.
The idea that there could be, for example, no common loons nesting right. in Minnesota by the year 2080.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is... that doesn't seem very far off. It'll be beyond my lifetime, but maybe not beyond yours, right?
Well, I think it's pretty sure. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah,
I could make it.
You'll still be doing radio, too, I'm sure.
Of course. And I'll also be giving a lot of interviews about what it's like to be 105. But
there you go.
So let's talk about pheasants. I mean, we've been talking about native species and how the climate is changing, how their area may change. Pheasants are not native to
Correct.
Iowa, right? But this is a species we spend a lot of time thinking about in this state.
Yeah, it's because they have such a huge economic and social impact. As a primarily agrarian state, we have a very strong hunting tradition here, and pheasants introduced very early in the 20th century and have done very, very well here. They're a grassland bird from China and have done very well in our grasslands, even in our modified grasslands, things like small grain crops and hay fields and pasture. Pheasants did very, very well for many years. If we think about them in the many of our listeners I know probably hunted pheasants in the 1950s and 1960s and 70s even, and saw these tremendous populations of birds. And since then, those that have been out and watching upland game bird populations since the 1980s, we've been seeing this incredible downward trend. Not every year, but the whole trend, if you look at it over the last 30 years, has been consistently downward. And so it's nice in a year finally to see an uptick in the pheasant population.
Well, I was just looking at news stories about it, and at the same time, news stories from almost exactly a year ago came up, and last year's population was very low, and there was a lot of doom and gloom out there about the future of pheasants in Iowa.
Absolutely.
Just a year ago. And yeah. Now this year, and I know that the DNR does their count by driving along roadways in Iowa, but all summer long I've been thinking, wow, there are a lot of pheasants out there.
You've been seeing some. That's
yes,
great.
A
yeah.
Ton.
And I know rural mail carriers and folks like that who are out on rural roads all the time, they notice the changes. It's really been interesting to me to talk to some of them, and they see these changes, you know, on a daily basis. Most of us don't unless you're commuting on a country road on a consistent basis, and really keep track. It's hard to see it, but we've had such a good uptick this year. I think you're right that people have noticed. Wow, there are a lot of pheasants out there.
Right. If you drive on these roads, it's hard not to notice,
right.
Honestly. And my dogs are thrilled as well. They've also been noticing again and again.
Now we have to keep this in perspective. Now, let me say, first of all, you mentioned that these are driven. These are regular routes. These are 30-mile routes. These are done by professionals. They're driven very early in the morning at first light. And only in the first 2 weeks of August, when you tend to have good dew conditions, pheasants don't like to be wet. And basically, what they do is they'll come out to the roads. They'll come out of the ditches and out of the grasslands, come out on the roadside and dry in the sun in the early morning. And so hens will bring their broods out and everything. And people will drive along these routes, these 30-mile routes, and count them.
All right, we're going to take a short break, Jim. We'll be right back in a moment. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Right now we're talking about pheasants. We'll talk about other game birds of Iowa. And you're welcome to join the conversation with your questions and your observations. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me today, and we're talking about pheasants right now. We'll talk about other game birds of Iowa as the hour goes on, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions and your observations. What have you been seeing a lot of this year? 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. 9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, I mean, for those of us who grew up in Iowa, pheasants are a part of the landscape. It's something that we think of when we think of the Iowa countryside. Obviously, for hunters, pheasants are an important part of Iowa. But since this is a non-native species, I mean, why should we get so excited if the population is higher?
Well, I think it's an indicator, and that's what the survey is every August. This is not an absolute count by any means. There are only a couple of routes per county that are driven, but they're driven consistently, and the protocol for taking the survey, and that's what this gives us, is an index. And I think even an index of pheasants, which is a non-native species, is an index to other species as well. So to me, it's an indicator of sort of what's happening in the countryside. Now, we get excited about, and the count has been this year, about 17 birds per route, okay? Now, we have to keep in mind that that is still less than half. The average over the whole length of the survey, the 50-plus years of the survey have been going on, is 40 birds per route. That indicates...
This is a six-year high,
right?
But we've been in a low period for a long time.
Yeah. And the overall trend since 1962 has been downward, and that is disturbing. Now, certainly there are years where it's up, years where it's down, but if you look at the overall sort of statistical trend, it's downward. And we can see years in the survey in which there are lots of things that impact bird reproduction, pheasant reproduction. Pheasants being a ground-dwelling, ground-nesting bird, it's a good indicator of both habitat and of weather. Weather has been the thing that has been most difficult for us. We had 6 years in a row of very cold, snowy winters and very cool, wet springs. And the two, the cold, snowy winters do not bode well for overwinter survival, particularly of hens, but pheasants in general, hens or roosters. And cool, wet springs are the thing that really, you know, will give the population a particular boot in the rear end, you know.
So this year we had a fairly cool spring, but it was drier.
Wasn't
than it
as
has
wet.
Been.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So those rains that came in June didn't wash away.
Well, the young were old enough by then. See, they get exposure. They get basically hypothermia and cold, wet weather. Whether it's, you know, where it's wet all day long and it doesn't give them a chance to dry out. The little buggers can't survive that, and they basically go into hypothermic shock and die. So, or they can't find enough insects, or they can't find enough food to keep their energy levels up and keep their temperatures up. So they just continue to go downhill very quickly, and in a few days, particularly if they're very, very young, they don't stand a chance in that sort of consistently wet weather.
And now, so this year, the weather was really just right for the pheasants, although we still have this habitat loss.
Yeah, and that has been, you know, I know our listeners are used to hearing me preach this all the time, but it's true. It's all about habitat, and you look at the change in our landscape over the last 50 years has been terrific, an incredible amount of change over that time period from a landscape that had a lot of small fields with small grains, a lot of hay crop, a lot of mixed agriculture, lots of fence rows that were messy and had lots of shrubs and weeds coming up in them. It was terrific pheasant and quail habitat. To today, when we have almost no fence rows, we have huge fields of monocultural crops where the weeds are very, very much controlled, and we don't have weedy fields anymore. And we have more land under row crop production than we've ever had in history. And that in itself says we're not going to have you look at those trends and you say we're not going to have the populations of birds, be they pheasants or quail or whatever you want to talk about, that we had probably in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s.
Now, we've talked about this before, but it's such an interesting story to me. We're going to talk about it again, Jim. But, you know, I mentioned that these pheasants are not native to Iowa.
Right.
Once again, my kids and I are rereading the Little House on the Prairie books.
Ah.
And they're saying, well, I think I saw a prairie chicken, and I told them, no, you didn't see a prairie chicken. We just saw a pheasant. So are pheasants in the ecological place in our environment in Iowa that prairie chickens were once in?
Yes and no. Certainly they have taken the niche of a ground-dwelling bird that is a resident in Iowa. a gallinaceous bird, they're called, ground-dwelling birds that feed and nest on the ground, that prairie chickens used to occupy. The difference is that pheasants are more tolerant of a much more fragmented landscape than fragmented by roads, by row crop agriculture, by cities and towns than prairie chickens are. Prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse, particularly prairie chickens, were once here in great numbers, for sure. And people say, well, gee, we should get rid of all the pheasants and just reintroduce prairie chickens. Well, all we have to do is look at the prairie chickens in southern Iowa. We do have some prairie chickens here around the Kellerton area in south central Iowa. But they have to have very large areas of continuous grassland in order to survive in any kinds of numbers. And we no longer have that in Iowa. The closest place is in parts of Nebraska and North Dakota, South Dakota and North Dakota, where you have some very large grasslands, and it's a very different landscape than we now have here.
All right. So even, I mean, and I know that the prairie chickens in southern Iowa have been protected and brought in to that area.
Right.
But even if we tried to do that across the rest of the state, we just don't have the habitat to support that species.
Exactly. Exactly. There's not enough continuous grassland habitat really anywhere else in the state to support prairie chicken populations again.
We're talking about game birds this hour. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me, and you're welcome to join the conversation with your questions and your observations. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, I want to talk about turkeys, and this is based on pure anecdotal evidence. I may just get lucky a lot this year, but I have seen a lot of turkeys this year as well, including a mama with, gosh, she must have had 16 or 17.
Wow.
Following her just a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
And they're teenage turkeys now, so
right.
It's a pretty big group.
Yeah.
But are we seeing more turkeys, and do we know?
Well, I don't know that this survey that is done in August, they pick up a few turkeys along the way because turkeys do some of the same things, except that what we're really dealing with is different habitats. There are certainly turkeys that inhabit the grasslands that pheasants are in. My dog one time pointed a turkey for me on a pheasant hunt, and I know she was really excited. Boy, Jim's really going to love this. And then when I didn't shoot, when the turkey came up, she looked at me like, what the heck, man? You know, what's wrong with you? So there are turkeys in grasslands and in prairie, but they're much more of a woodland and woodland edge bird. And so this particular survey doesn't pick them up as much as it does pheasants and quail.
But the weather conditions being so favorable to pheasants,
right,
would that also have been very favorable,
sure,
to turkeys this,
sure,
year?
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. And that will help them, although they will nest a little bit earlier even than some pheasants will, and they're tougher. They really are. I mean, they're bigger and tougher than pheasant chicks are. Still, the weather conditions impact turkey populations. So I think you're right. I think there should be good turkey populations this fall, and hopefully going into winter we'll have good overwinter survival as well.
Now, we've talked about turkeys in the past as well, and turkeys are not very tolerant of disturbances in that nesting season, are they?
Yeah, it's different than pheasants and quail. Pheasants and quail, if they get disturbed or if their nest gets eaten by a snake or a fox or a skunk or a raccoon, they will usually re-nest in a different location. Not in the same location, but they will go and re-nest. It seems like about 90 to 95% of the time that kind of disturbance in a turkey brood, though, they will not re-nest. They're done for the year. And so that there is a difference between the two, that's for sure.
So with turkeys, given this lack of habitat that we have, they're also more likely to be disturbed because,
right,
our habitats are closer to roads and closer to people.
That's exactly right. And see, that's the thing. I mean, we've lost, a tremendous amount of CRP, Conservation Reserve Program habitat. We've lost a terrific amount of woodland habitat. And while turkeys are much more tolerant than we originally thought they would be of more fragmented woodlands, we used to think they needed 1,000 acres of continuous woodland in order to survive when they were first reintroduced to the state. But that isn't the case. It turns out that they can take small bits of woodland that are broken up by cropland and roadsides and that, and they do pretty darn well in the state. So it's a very different habitat picture for them, though, than it is for pheasants.
It's such a fun bird to see. Where do you go if you want to see turkeys?
Oh, gee. If you want to see turkeys, actually, they're present all across the state. And certainly near any woodland area, you could go to, it depends where you are in the state, but you could go to most state parks, state wildlife areas, and many of the, particularly if they contain any woodland at all, along our rivers in almost any part of the state. And where there is some woodland, and a lot of county conservation board areas have turkeys in them. Take a walk in your local county conservation board park, and chances are pretty good. If you're away from the buildings and that, you're probably going to see some turkeys.
Now, of course, a lot of people love to scare up a pheasant, and you hear that whirr of the whirr of the wings as it goes up. Watching turkeys take off is really a stunning display as well, I think.
It's like a B-52 by comparison. they are a very large bird, and you're right. It's a boom, 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 as they take off.
And they really kind of need a runway area.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they can take off by jumping up in the air, but they it helps them to get off if they run a little bit, that's for sure.
And it's always fun if you see a whole group of 20 or so of them. And do they get together? Do they tend to gather in flocks in the fall?
Yeah, they do. As a matter of fact, they are in during the summer. It's the hen and her chicks, and there are flocks of non-breeding hens sometimes together with mostly bachelor males. Toms that are done breeding or didn't get a chance to breed or weren't quite old enough or whatever. And so you'll have these sort of sex-linked flocks, hens and chicks, and more toms with other toms. But in the fall, they'll tend to roost, get closer together, and begin to mix much more. And often during the wintertime, you'll see these mixed flocks of turkeys roosting in the same area. So you may see, after the fields are harvested, you may see turkeys out in the middle of fields, and there may be 30, 40, 50 birds out there of young and old hens and toms mixed all together, and it's a pretty remarkable sight.
Now, of course, when you see turkeys in a distance, they don't look exactly like the turkeys that you draw pictures of when you're in first grade and the ones that you think about Benjamin Franklin with. But they do have some pretty impressive displays if you catch them at the right time.
Yeah, if you're thinking about the spread tail, that is only the done by the toms, and their wings down, and they're making a booming sound that is very hard for me to imitate at this moment. But their feathers are their wings are very, very tight, and they're pushing against the wind with those wings. So it's an impressive sound, and it's only the toms, the adult male roosters that do that, and the hens don't. And it's only when they have that red head is especially during the breeding season. You'll see it a little bit in the fall. But it's primarily during the breeding season when the blood rushes up to their head, and so they can be impressive with that that bright red head and the things that are hanging down from their neck.
So that's when we really get the iconic image,
right,
of a turkey, and seeing two tom turkeys in their full plumage,
full
with
strut,
those red heads, yeah, arguing with one another.
Well, they're just discussing things.
Right. So. No, I saw her first.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And they have that red, but they also have a blue, right?
Yes, there is. There are blue parts of their of the featherless regions of their head as well. So yeah, it's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
All right, and then you do see a little more of a similarity between the artwork that your children bring home.
Right.
During breeding
season. A little more similarity. Anyway. Yeah, that's right.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We've got a number of people on the line. We'll get to calls as soon as we get back from the break. We'd also love to hear from you with your questions and your observations of game birds in Iowa. With me today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking about game birds with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. And Jim, here's a question from Don. He says, from Cedar Rapids to Manchester, of course, you're not going to know the answer to this, but he's wondering what the population of pheasants is compared to that overall state figure. But he wants to help repopulate the pheasant population. He's wondering if there's anything he can do.
Yeah, every landowner, particularly if you own, rural land, we're talking beyond, the normal homeowner's acreage, but probably 10 or more acres, anything you do to provide habitat means that the birds and mammals in the area will have a better chance of surviving winter, surviving summer storms, and getting a brood off that year. So every landowner that has some. You know, one of the things I talked about a little bit last month, Charity, when I was talking about the water tails from water trails program, was that there certainly are differences in culture across the state and in terms of how people, larger landowners, treat the land. And you see it as you paddle down any river, and I think if you drive down any road, you can see it. Because in some areas, people are very concerned about the other critters with whom we share this earth, be they pheasants, quail, songbirds, whatever. And they show that concern by the kinds of habitat that are provided on their land. They have wide fence rows. They leave the fence rows in. They have messy areas. They leave those small bits of habitat here and there instead of putting them back under the plow. When I paddled down rivers, I saw places where consistently landowners fenced their cattle out of the rivers. They left buffer strips along the rivers and areas where the opposite was true. So there are different cultures within, sort of subcultures, I'd say, within different parts of the state. And so I think, as Iowans, we want to be proud of our state in many aspects, both its productive potential for food and also its productive potential for wildlife. And I'm glad to hear that Don is concerned about that. And so any habitat he can provide can do that. Relative to what the population is in his his area, it is certainly he can go online to the report. And let me see if I can find, if you go to www.iowadnr.gov /pheasants, and you can, I think that's what it is. Let me see if I can find the URL. I think it's /pheasants. You can go and get this distribution, /pheasant survey. So it's okay. www.iowadnr.gov/pheasant survey. And he can see the complete report and see what the trends are in his certain area of the state.
Right. So the answer is habitat. I know some people want to get pheasant chicks and just introduce them into the wild, but habitat is the answer.
Habitat's the key, because study after study after study shows that pheasants raised in captivity really just don't survive very well. They survive into the fall, and they provide great hunting temporarily. But in terms of raising the overall game population of pheasants, or be they quail or whatever, pen-raised birds do not measure up and don't survive very well at all.
All right. Sam is on the line next from Earlville. Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question here. I went to school at South Dakota State and have some friends out west of the Missouri where I still go back and hunt annually. And obviously the terrain's a little bit different out that way. But the farmers out there have really, as you probably know, you know, they're farming for pheasants and using that towards the, you know, they're making more than they would off the land for, you know, your typical row farming.
Right.
I guess my question, in order to, and even east of the river, you know, where the farming practices are similar to here in Iowa, it seems like they have a lot more pheasants. But my question is, in Iowa here, in order to up the numbers, has it ever been thought of to, you know, open the season at noon? I know they do that out there for the first couple weekends at least.
Right.
Yep. Or it possibly lower the bag limit, or even, you know, close the season for a year or so to help get those populations back up there. I'll just hang up and listen. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right, sure. Sam, thanks a lot for your call.
Yeah, some great questions there. Yes, first of all, the land is very different out there. However, I would note that South Dakota has had some of the same problems we have had the last several years. Number one, loss of habitat. $6 corn drove a lot of people to put what had been grassland for decades under the plow and plant corn, even in South Dakota. So their trends, their pheasant populations the last several years have been down from their long-term trends, even though they're higher than ours because they have much more grassland, they have many more small grains, they have, he was absolutely right, there are some ranchers and farmers out there that farm specifically for pheasants. I've hunted out on ranches out there in which they even delayed the cutting of the hay to get past the hunting season, or they would alternate fields. They might cut part of one field during the for a first cutting of hay, but they would not cut the other half of it until the normal third cutting time, specifically to give pheasants a chance. And he's right. It's for-profit hunting out there. It's very different than the traditions in Iowa. And relative to his questions about whether they have considered these other things, wildlife biologists talk all the time about, gee, how could we do this? But you're dealing with not only the impact on the birds, but you're dealing with the impact on small towns, on economics, and all sorts of things, and politics, to say, you know, that prevent us from doing some of these things that might be interesting experimentally, but might be devastating to an area that really depends on income from pheasant hunters in the winter. So, you know, it's a tough thing. It's not a single There's not a single answer, I don't think. But yes, there's lots of things under consideration.
Well, and I'm sure, I mean, that's a question a lot of people have, because they think if we're worried about this population, why are we killing them?
Right, yeah. And what you look at then in terms of game bird populations, we know that there is a harvestable surplus, so that once you reach that harvestable surplus, X percent of the population is going to die over the winter, be it through predators, through weather, or through human hunting predators, another form of predation, and that once you get below that, then it doesn't impact the population. If you stay above that, you're still going to lose some a certain percentage of the population no matter what. So that what they strive to do is to take only the harvestable surplus, and there are lots and lots of studies that show that we're not close to that harvestable surplus. So I don't think smaller bag limits or possession limits at this point would impact this at this point because of the severe habitat loss. And let me give you some statistics to show you what kind of loss we're talking about. So we're talking about a piece of the change in Iowa between 1990 and 2013. Iowa lost over 2,800, so 2,800, almost 2,900 square miles of potential pheasant habitat. That was a mix of small grains and hay and conservation reserve program acres. As in recent years, because prices were so high for commodity crops, farmers chose not to re-up into the conservation reserve program. So if you think about that, what is 2,800, almost 2,900 square miles of land? That is a strip of habitat. We're talking grassland habitat, 9 miles wide, was stretched from one side of the state, from Omaha clear to Davenport. That's a lot of land.
Right. Well, and you called it potential pheasant habitat, but clearly that's potential habitat for many
for
species.
All kinds of things. Exactly. So it really is, when you're dealing with that kind of habitat loss, even closing the season or smaller bag limits, it's not going to impact it nearly as much as the habitat loss does.
All right. Tom is on the line next in Iowa City, I think, with a related question. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I was just questioning. I hear you guys talk a lot about habitat loss, but I don't hear you talk about predator deprivation of all that pheasants too, either.
Yeah, that's a good question. But part of habitat is being is having habitat in which you can escape predation as well as escape weather conditions. So that's part of habitat. It's not just, oh, there are grasses growing here, but it's the insects that might be there for young pheasants to eat because they need high bits of protein. It's a protection from the escape routes from predators. You are correct in that we have had some higher populations of some predators, particularly things like raccoons, skunks in some areas, for a number of years now, in part because of quite honestly, lower rates of trapping by humans for fur. If there's decent habitat, they're going to be able to survive that. But you're right, that contributes to it as well.
Well, and I guess from your perspective, wouldn't the predators also be a sign of healthier habitats?
In some respects, yeah, I think that's true.
A sign of success,
yeah.
if we're doing things right. There are going to also be a predator population.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Well. And Mel wants to turn the conversation to a different type of game bird. Mel is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Mel.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
Related to doves, not all of us were in favor of the dove bill when it passed.
Right.
And some of us were horrified about the lead shot allowance. So I'm curious, how widespread is dove hunting, and are we seeing any of, and are people using lead shot, and are we seeing effects from that?
Okay, first question is there lead shot used in mourning dove hunting? Yes, there is. It was allowed. To my way of thinking, I think it was unfortunate that could have not used lead shot and used only non-toxic shot, it would have been a good thing for many reasons, not the least of which were political. But the fact is that it doesn't. How widespread is it? There's dove hunting all over the state. The season runs September 1 through, November 9th. And will it impact the mourning dove population? No more so than normal mortality and hunting in all the states surrounding us already do. So it, I think biologically, dove hunting has been shown to be not have an impact on the population. Now, the other question is a much more complex question, is that has lead shot, and this is different than lead bullets in for deer hunting, but has lead shot impacted other species? That's a much tougher question to answer, because we have to assume that, first of all, species will pick up lead shot. Secondly, that we can even find them if they did ingest it, and to prove that it had some impact. But I think it's to me, it is time that we went ahead. I can tell you, I hunt upland birds and have for a number of years now, and I've been using steel shot wherever I go. Just because I think it's the right thing to do.
And there is evidence that it moves up the food chain.
Sure.
There has been lead poisoning found in bald eagles, for example.
Right. That's probably most of that is through ingestion directly of lead, though, from carcasses of deer that have been shot by, the lead ball has wedged somewhere in the guts that are the gut piles that are left, and the birds scavenge on it and pick up the lead directly. But if a bird ingests some shot, they're certainly not going to survive very long. So the question is whether they ingest it. And I think the jury, science-wise, the jury is still out on that. But given that, we've already decided, we know for sure that waterfowl ingest lead shot from the bottoms of lakes. So it makes some sense that upland birds and other species might ingest lead shot in grassland area, in terrestrial areas. So I think it's the right thing to do use steel, but the politics of that are more difficult to get that passed.
Well, and if you're interested in that, we've done a number of shows on that on River to River. So
sure.
You can go back on the iowapublicradio.org site and take a look at that as well. Mel, thank you so much for your call. And Jim, we're nearly out of time. And of course, not all of us are hunters. A lot of us want to see these species out in the wild because they're beautiful. And it's getting to be autumn, which is the most amazing time of the year to get out there.
It sure is.
Where should we go if we want to see some of these species?
I would say start with your state and county parks and wildlife areas in your areas. Be sure and check with the County Conservation Board to see if it's if you don't know about hunting seasons, when the hunting seasons are, which of their areas. Yeah, and be safe. Just to be on the safe side, wear orange while you're out there, and so you can be seen as well. And again, if they want to go to that website and learn more about this, they can go to www.iowadnr.gov/pheasant survey, and it has pheasant, quail, cottontail rabbits, and others.
And the best time of day for your hike?
Oh, early morning or evening probably is when you're going to see the most birds.
All right. Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Get out there, whatever you do.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He'll be back again next month. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, a forgotten battle of the Civil War. This is Talk of Iowa.